Psalm 90. Lord, you have been our dwelling place throughout all generations. Before the mountains were born, or you brought forth the whole world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You turn people back to dust, saying, "Return to dust, you mortals." 1,000 years in your sight are like a day that has just gone by, or like a watch in the night. Yet you sweep people away in the sleep of death. They are like the new grass of the morning. In the morning it springs up new, but by evening it is dry and withered. We are consumed by your anger and terrified by your indignation. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. All our days pass away under your wrath. We finish our years with a moan. Our days may come to 70 years or 80 if our strength endures. Yet the best of them are but trouble and sorrow, for they quickly pass and we fly away. If only we knew the power of your anger. Your wrath is as great as the fear that is your due. Teach us to number our days, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Relent, Lord. How long will it be? Have compassion on your servants. Satisfy us in the morning with your unfailing love, that we may sing for joy and be glad all our days. Make us glad for as many days as you have afflicted us, for as many years as we have seen trouble. May your deeds be shown to your servants, your splendor to their children. May the favor of the Lord our God rest on us. Establish the work of our hands for us. Yes, establish the work of our hands.
Do take your seats. Again, it's great to see everyone here this morning. It's wonderful to be here to take the opportunity to remember this morning as we've just been doing. We're going to be having a look at that Psalm 90, which Dave read to us. If you'd like to have it open in front of you so that you can keep an eye on it, it's on page 599 of the Blue Bibles that are scattered around. The hymn that we've just sung is one that very often features in remembrance ceremonies. It will be sung by many people today and many more on Wednesday, Armistice Day itself. It's a hymn that's developed national and military associations over many years, though that wasn't the original intention when the great hymn writer Isaac Watts published it in 1719. Our gods, our help in ages past. It was sung at the conference of Winston Churchill and President Roosevelt in August 1941 at the height of the Second World War when they met at sea to discuss the Atlantic Charter. And the picture shows the service on the deck of HMS Prince of Wales, the battleship where the hymn was sung. Churchill chose the hymn to be sung at his own funeral. It was in fact the final hymn at that service in 1965, sung as the great man's coffin was borne out of St. Paul's Cathedral. But I wonder what people think of and what's in their minds when they sing those opening lines, "Our God, our help in ages past, our hope for years to come." What kind of help? What sort of hope? In wartime, it's easy to think what kind of help we need. We want to get through the war. We want to be victorious. We want our freedom to be preserved. And no doubt that is the way it has often been sung through the years in wartime. But what are we hoping for when we sing it now? It's addressed to God, but what kind of help and hope do we expect from there? Isaac Watts certainly knew what he meant by these lines, because he based the hymn on the words of this psalm, Psalm 90 in the Bible, which we read. The psalms are the songbook of old Israel, written over a long period of time for the people to sing, to celebrate, and to cry out to God in times of need, in all kinds of circumstances, good or tough. And this one, Psalm 90, is probably the oldest of them all, because its heading tells us it is a prayer of Moses, the man of God. And in fact, that rings true because its lines echo words of his that are recorded in the early books of the Bible, which tell his story. Moses was the man who led Israel out of slavery in Egypt and brought them through the desert to the edge of the promised land. That great event we call the Exodus happened around 1500 BC. And if we look into his words here, we'll find that the hope expressed in the hymn is not just pious words set to a stirring tune to boost our spirits a bit. No, this is solid reality. Here there is hope for us that will hold firm even in the face of death, whatever kind of death we will each eventually have to face. These are words to help us this morning. And the psalm is based around two contrasts, two pairs of opposites, and that's what we'll look at now. Here's the first of those contrasts, eternity and a moment. Eternity and a moment. And the contrast here is between God, who is eternal, and us, who are here today and gone tomorrow. Listen again to some of the opening words of the psalm. Lord, you have been our dwelling place throughout all generations. Before the mountains were born, or you brought forth the whole world from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. 1,000 years in your sight are like a day that has just gone by, or like a watch in the night. You see, we think of the world as a permanent fixture, the mountains. Think of the Brecon Beacons, the mountains nearest to us here, somewhere that many of us have been to, hiked there. Some of you have probably trained on those mountains. As you have pounded those hills, you won't have been thinking, the ground under my feet has just appeared or it's about to disappear anytime soon. We think those mountains are permanent, but not so. God was around long before those mountains. And he'll be here long after they have gone, because he made them. When and how he made them doesn't matter for now. When and how certainly doesn't matter compared to the solid fact that God is the creator and he is eternal. He goes back to infinity past and he extends to eternity future. Look at this on God's time scales. 1,000 years are like a day. And that's not intended as a strict equation. Some people interpreted it that way in the past. 1,000 years for God equals and exactly a day. Because the next line says, 1,000 years to God are like a watch in the night. 3 or 4 hours, that is, depending on which system you're using. To a century standing guard in the night. Well, his watch might seem like a long stretch because it's pretty boring. But in the grand scheme of things, it's nothing. 1,000 years to God is like that. A fleeting moment to the one who created time itself. To God who in fact stands outside time and sees all its moments together in a single glance. Eternity is beyond understanding. We can't get our heads around it. At least, not in this life. God himself is beyond our understanding. From everlasting, you are God, to endless years. The same. And us, how different we are. Look at this from verse 3. You turn people back to dust, saying, return to dust, you mortals. Verse 5. Yet you sweep people away in the sleep of death. They are like the new grass of the morning. In the morning it springs up new, but by evening it is dry and withered. Dust to dust, say the words of the old funeral service. In the story of creation, man is made from the dust of the ground. It's a way of saying that our bodies are made of ordinary stuff, the ordinary elements that the whole world, the earth, is made up of. And to dust we return at the end of life. It's literally true. And it happens so quickly. See how it's pictured here, the sleep of death. Another possible translation says we're like a dream. You can barely even remember it the moment you wake up. It's gone. As the day dawns, we're like new grass, the new grass of a Middle Eastern country, fresh, springing up fresh with the morning dew, but by evening, scorched, withered, and dry. It's not a very glorious picture compared to how we like to think of ourselves. A few blades of grass for the mower to cut. death is on its way for all of us. And we don't know when it will strike. An airliner falls out of the sky. Everyone on board is dead without warning. It could have been an EasyJet flight to Bristol. It could have been one of us, any of us on board that plane. And that's peacetime. What about wartime? Churchill and Roosevelt met on board HMS Prince of Wales. If you know your military history, you will know what happened to that mighty ship just 4 months later. That deck where those words were sung. Sunk by enemy aircraft in the Pacific with the loss of 327 lives. No one knows when death will come. For many, of course, our end will not come in an event that makes headlines. It will come quietly, privately, and we hope peacefully. But death in a hospital bed or in our own beds at home is just as terminal. And people today spend time and effort avoiding all thought of death and staving it off for as long as possible, making ourselves look young while we can. We are uncomfortable discussing the subject. And we will do all we can to distract ourselves from it. There shall not be a minute of silence on most days to contemplate what must happen to us one day. The Bible, by contrast, is very honest and straightforward about the reality of death. Repeatedly brings us face to face with death, and it does us a huge favor by doing so. There is no hiding here, no pretending. Death is real. We are creatures of a moment, eternity and a moment. The second contrast in the psalm is this, a curse and a hope. Look at verse 7 of the psalm, and prepare to be shocked. We are consumed by your anger and terrified by your indignation. You've set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. All our days pass away under your wrath. We finish our years with a moan. This is where we learn that God is not actually the distant, uninvolved old man that we sometimes like to think. There is a reason why human life is often short and always painful. There's a reason why God says here, return to dust. The original design for the human race did not involve death. Death came into the world because the first human beings decided to reject God's rule and care. Adam and Eve chose not to believe that God was good. They rebelled against him. They sinned. And God declared the death sentence on them and the whole human race that would follow. This is what God says to Adam. In Genesis 3, verse 19, right back at the beginning, God says, by the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken. For dust you are, and to dust you will return. Psalm 90 echoes those words, reminding us why it is that we must die. Sin is the problem that we, as a race, are rebels against our Creator. What Adam and Eve did at the beginning, on the fourth page of a 1,200-page Bible that tells the story of the world, what they did, we all do. We all turn away from God. We all think we have the right to decide what is good and right and what is not. We all grasp at being little gods ourselves and ruling our own worlds. That is sin. And God is rightly angry with our sin because there is only one real God in the universe and it's Him. He is angry with our sin. That is His wrath, as it's called here. And that is why we live short lives and die. We face not a kindly, indifferent old man in the sky, but a fearsome judge who cannot be avoided, cannot be distracted, cannot be bribed. That is not an easy, cool, or trendy picture of God. It may not be how the man in the street wants to think about God, but this is the true picture of God as the Bible reveals him. And surely what we need to know is the truth, not what feels nice. And as these words tell us, even what we do in secret is clearly visible to him. When the day of judgment comes, even what we have done out of sight will be brought to light, and we will have to answer for it. This day is coming. There will be no way of avoiding it. We will be condemned to eternal death, and that sentence will be right. It will be fully deserved. The people who are terrified of God are not mentally ill. They are not deluded. They have glimpsed the truth. The real God is terrifying. Verse 9 here makes the explicit connection between God's wrath against our sin and our shortness of life. Death is a grim reality, and it is such an anticlimax. In the famous words of T.S. Eliot, this is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper. It's true. 70 or 80 years is what we get, says verse 10. Our days may come to 70 years or 80 if our strength endures. Yet the best of them are but trouble and sorrow, for they quickly pass and we fly away. If you look around the world, that is still a pretty good score, 70 or 80 years, though modern medicine has raised it a little higher in the West. We may get beyond 80 years. My dad is 101. One of his first memories is sheltering from the Zeppelin raids in the First World War. But those years still come with trouble and sorrow, whatever kind of life we lead. We fly away, and mostly we are soon forgotten, like a dream. However we may dress it up, death is real. The Bible helps us to see that. It helps us by not pretending, by not being sentimental. And if death is something we push away because the thought is so uncomfortable, this fact of judgment makes us more uneasy still. We are offenders against God. Sin has brought a curse on the whole world that applies to every single one of us. It is sin that poisons our relationships with one another, with hatred, with bitterness, resentment, harsh words, betrayal. It is sin that sets nations against each other. It is sin that produces wars that kill millions and devastate uncounted lives. And Moses, as he writes, knows that we need to think about this and we need to respond. These words ought to banish our fanciful notions and our wishful thinking about God and the afterlife. Verse 11, if only we knew the power of your anger. Your wrath is as great as the fear that is your due. Teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Yes, if we're wise, we will recognize where we stand before God. We will see that he stands against us in our sinfulness. We will recognize that he is vast and we are tiny. Our days are few, and we will use those days to seek God. Great news, of course, is that the psalm doesn't end there. It goes on. There is a hope. After all, it began with this in verse 1. Lord, you've been our dwelling place throughout all generations. Now, that does not sound unhopeful. God doesn't sound like an enemy there. Beyond the curse, there is a hope. And the psalm moves on to prayer. Verse 13, relent, Lord. How long will it be? Have compassion on your servants. God has said, return to dust. Here, these words literally say, God, Lord, you return, relent, turn back, have compassion on us. We need your help here. We can see that. And from what comes next, clearly there is a real hope that God will answer. Satisfy us in the morning with your unfailing love, that we may sing for joy and be glad all our days. Make us glad for as many days as you've afflicted us, for as many years as we have seen trouble. Moses knows what he's asking for. He can imagine having God not as an enemy, but somehow as a loving, benevolent friend. He can picture getting up in the morning and facing the day, not with guilty dread, but with satisfaction, because he knows that he's loved by the God of all the earth. To be satisfied in the love of God. That's what he's praying for. To be glad instead of terrified. And he seems to think that God will give him what he's asking for. Moses prays that God's actions will be seen. May your deeds be shown to your servants, your splendor to their children. Moses himself has seen the Exodus, those great and fearful events where God has sent the 10 plagues against Egypt, destroyed that enemy country and many of its people. He has seen how God miraculously brought the nation of Israel out of Egypt, opened a way through the Red Sea for them to pass, and then wiped out the pursuing army in the water. He's seen the appearance of God at Mount Sinai, where the mountain was covered in fire and cloud and smoke, and he's been up the mountain to speak one-to-one with God himself. Unimaginable what that was like. He has seen God work in power to save and take care of his people. He's been there. When Moses speaks about God's deeds being shown, that's what he has in mind. That's the splendor of God he wants their children to see. The good news is, we have seen something that's even better than that. We have seen God's greatest deeds. So what's the greatest thing that God has ever done to rescue people? Open up a road through the sea? Better than that. Overthrow an enemy army? No, better again. God's greatest ever rescue was to have his son, Jesus Christ, executed on a wooden cross. Executed by exactly the same kind of people that he was coming to rescue. The cross is a much bigger and better rescue than digging the Israelites out of Egypt. It's a much bigger battle than any of the battles of history. Because when he went willingly to die on the cross, Jesus Christ defeated the power of sin. He fought and won the great war. He did that by taking judgment and condemnation and God's wrath in place of us. He faced the terror of death. He took the penalty deserved by us, even though he was completely innocent himself. The greatest rescue plan in history. A Christian is someone who has seen that they're a sinner, an offender in the sight of God, who has recognized what that means, that they face judgment from God because of their sin, who has then seen what Jesus Christ crucified, God's rescue plan for helpless people, and trusted Jesus to forgive them, to take that condemnation away, and to put them right with God. God is a stern and uncompromising judge. He is the awesome God of eternity, but he's also a God of love. And he's created this way of escape for us. It costs the agony and death of his beloved son, who is God himself. But God decided it was worth the cost. It was worth what it cost him because he so wanted to have the relationship healed and to bring us home to him. And so he did. It's done. We might feel that we should make some contribution to this plan. After all, we're the guilty ones. Shouldn't we do something to put things right? But the truth is, we can't do that. There is nothing at all we can contribute. In this particular peace conference, we bring nothing at all to the table except the problem, our sin. God, on the other hand, brings everything. His justice, his love, his compassion, his power. Above all, he brings the death of his son, the Lord Jesus. We have nothing good to bring to the table. We come to surrender. And there is something wonderful for us to take away. When we trust in Jesus Christ, we are forgiven. Our past is dealt with and we have a new beginning, a clean conscience. No more guilt to crush us. Our future is secure. Not eternal death, but eternal life. In fact, what we take away is the answer to the prayers in this psalm. The unfailing love of God to satisfy us. There is nothing else in this life that will ultimately satisfy us. A great career, a lovely family, a beautiful home, great relationships. In the end, they will all fail. They will all die, just like we will. The only thing that will ultimately satisfy us is knowing God through Jesus Christ. He will. Joy and gladness, says here, yes, now we really have something to sing about. Because this hope will never disappoint us. There is hope for our kids, verse 16. Don't we worry about our children growing up in this broken and troubled world? What will happen to them? I certainly have thought that many times. But they can have the same hope that we now have. They can know Jesus Christ too. And he will see them all the way through life, through death, and into eternity. And our work is not pointless, verse 17, because our lives are no longer pointless. Knowing Jesus Christ, life means something. It's going somewhere good. He gives value to our work here and now, whatever kind of work we do. And meanwhile, he's working in this life to make us like him and get us ready for the next one. God has been our help in ages past. He has rescued our nation from many dangers. We need to cultivate the memories of those days. Thanks to God, we have freedom in this land. And we should always be grateful for that because it means so much and pledge ourselves to defend it. But here is something even better than that. God also offers each of us an eternal land, an eternal home, a dwelling place for eternity. Our God, our help in ages past, our hope for years to come. Be our defense while life shall last and our eternal home. Just have a moment's quiet to think about that. Just think, have you reckoned with the reality of an eternal God who will judge every one of us? And have you seen Jesus Christ and what he will do for you if you turn to him? We'd love to talk to you more about this. If you'd like to know more, the welcome pack that's around on the table over there has a card. You can tick a box to find out more. We'll be in touch with you. Or to talk to someone afterwards. Talk to Mark, who led the service. Talk to me. Talk to anyone here. Talk to a Christian friend. Knowing Jesus Christ is the most important thing in this life. There is nothing else that comes within a million miles of it. And we love talking about Jesus, and we'd love to share more about that hope with you now or at any other time. We're going to finish this time together now by singing again. We're going to sing another of the great historic hymns that we love to sing that reminds us of God's truth and faithfulness, how he keeps his promises year after year and every season of the year. Great is thy faithfulness. So let's stand and sing.